Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for tuning in today and to every other episode. Thanks for staying engaged with us on social media and for giving us those reviews on iTunes. If it's your first time listening, welcome. We've got a great one for you today. And there's a reason that today I'm running solo. Sometimes when a guest is in a unique spot but has a story to tell, we're just going to try and get it recorded. So who we have on the line, Mr. Joe Peterson, who as we speak is on the fantail of the Coast Guard cutter Comanche, now decommissioned but serving as a museum ship and on its way to Seattle. So that's why we've got him. That's why I'm running solo on this one. Joe, for a little background, born in Missoula, Montana. His dad was in the Coast Guard back on the Coast Guard cutter Taney during World War II when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. He was in Pearl Harbor at the time. Joe can tell us a little more about that one. And in 1965, Joe himself was drafted and reported to recruit training in Alameda. First station was Yaquina Bay in Oregon, where he ran on the 36503, the 44300, and the 52312. I'm sure a lot of you surfmen and boat guys will recognize those hull numbers. He was there when the Soviet fleet kind of arrived off the west coast of the United States, and someone found out that he could speak Russian. As soon as they did, he was transferred onto the Coast Guard cutter Modoc, which was the twin or the sister ship of the Coast Guard cutter Comanche. Both of them were tasked with patrolling the Soviet fishing fleet off the western coast of the U.S. Stayed in until 1969 when he went ahead and transitioned to civilian life, became a civilian contractor for the Department of Defense, and retired in 2003. And with that, Joe, could you tell us your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Oh, danger, huh? Well, at the Coast Guard, the lifeboat station in Yaquina Bay, we did some heroic rescues, and on July the 4th, 1966, we rescued about 13 people out of the water. And one of the rescues, one of the seamen there received the Gold Lifesaving Medal for diving down inside a charter boat that had capsized on the bar, swimming up inside the cabin and cutting the woman free. She was tangled with her life preserver in things inside the cabin. He had the slugger to kind of numb her and then swim down and bring her up and out, and he saved her life.
It's kind of and, crazy. The stories where somebody always gets to save, somebody's got to get hit in the face. Do you ever notice that? Always the most dramatic.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, with with his name was Ron Paddock, and he was every bit coasty seaman. And he didn't give it any hesitation. He dived off. He took off his life jacket, and he dived and his shoes, and he dived into the water. It was rolling swells on the bar, and saved that woman's life. Now, it was interesting that the petty officers at the station thought he was crazy and shouldn't have done it, but it got in the news media the next day, and of course, he became a hero. And Ron was awarded the Gold Lifesaving Medal by the Coast Guard. That was an exciting one. I was in the tower at that one at Yacuna Bay, and because we were so busy that day, we had every floating object the Coast Guard had out there trying to deal with the situation. The fog had come in, the swells had come up, and there were many, many pleasure boats out there. And we were trying to get them in.
For the guys that don't understand the tower, you know, you never know who's listening, right?
Right.
Can you set the scene for us a little bit? What was stationed in Yacuna Bay? What was kind of your duty there? And then, you know, what was the duty in the tower that day? What did you see, I guess?
Okay. Yacuna Bay Station is a motor lifeboat station for rescue. And it's a beautiful situation. It's an idyllic Coast Guard station. Newport, Oregon is called Coast Guard Station, Coast Guard City Number 1. And the tower, there was a tall tower, I don't know how tall it was, maybe 60 feet, that was up there, and it would be manned 24/7, 365 by somebody who would listen for distress calls and such and watch the bar where the boats would come in and out of the channel there at Yacuna Bay and watch the bar for hazards, capsizing, boats going up on the rocks, on the jetty, and so on. And that was a tricky place to come in and out with a boat, particularly in bad weather. And that day, the fog rolled in, and I was in the tower, and I could see on the radar vessels coming up the wrong side of the jetty, and I would have to call the station and tell them. And nobody was left but the cook and the yeoman and a jeep, and they would drive down to the beach and get these people as they'd wash up on the beach through the surf. So there were a number of those.
No saving the boat, huh? Just
No, the boats just rolled over and washed up on the beach. It was a pretty good size. Yeah, we had a radar up there where we could watch out to, you know, 30, 40 miles.
Right.
To see what was going on and could track things that way. Now, this is all old World War II equipment, by the way.
Sure.
Stuff. But, you know, it worked.
Looking down the scope at the radar.
Yeah, screen. You had right. And you'd look in the scope and you could see the various blips on there from different sorts of floating objects out in the ocean. And like I say, I could see them coming up on the wrong sides of the jetty. The fog was so thick they couldn't tell what side, where the mouth of the Yacuana Bay was, so they'd go up the wrong side.
Right.
And so we had it was quite a day there at Yacuana Bay Station, which has had a number of heroes, and Tom McAdams, who is one of the outstanding enlisted men of the Coast Guard. He's retired in his 80s now. He was one CO there.
I think he designed the coxswain insignia, I'm pretty sure. I think that's attributed.
Oh, well, I think he did. He's number one, I believe.
Yeah, Master
Chief and
McAdams.
He's still a... Yeah, Master Chief McAdams. Yeah, I knew him, and I saw him there a few years ago at a reunion, and he's doing pretty good.
Great.
And so they have a wall of heroes in there with those who have won gold medals, and McAdams and Ron Paddock are right next to each other on their wall of heroes.
Joe, when you got there, was the wall of heroes there?
No, there was nothing like that there. No.
Right. Yeah,
Matter of fact, there wasn't even any school to learn to be a coxswain. You learn by the seat of your pants. The first day I arrived there after boot camp, I went out. They sent me out on a SAR case on a 36-footer, on the 36503. And so you learn there by the seat of your pants. So I do not believe that Cape Disappointment down on the Columbia River had been developed yet.
Right.
So I learned it there.
I still like to say that no matter if there's a coxswain score or not, I still think most of us learn by the seat of our pants. You don't really learn anything in this situation, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And then you have to deal with it.
Right.
And that's exactly what you have to do. And the water there is very cold, by the way. you do your best to stay out of it. Right. And then the other incident that happened there was the Coast Guard or the Soviet fishing fleet arrived in mass off the Oregon coast in April, off the Oregon and Washington and Northern California. And this was quite a surprise and quite a shock to the population and to the Coast Guard. We did not expect this. And there was a medical evacuation in early May.
Joe, how did that happen? So, I mean, I'm trying to think of it now. Like, one day somebody woke up, looked through the binoculars, and there was the Soviet fleet. Like, did they recognize it for what it was? Was it a...
You could actually hear them on the radio talking before you could see them, of course. We could hear them coming. And that's what got me interested in studying Russian, was listening to them on the radio. And I bought myself a Berlitz Learn It Yourself phrase book in Russian and started to study that. And I had to learn the Cyrillic first so I could be able to read the Russian words. And that's what I was doing at the time that they showed up. Just before everything got exciting for me there, I was in a waterfront tavern, one of those seedy sailor taverns called the Bar Gin in Newport, Oregon.
Yeah, none of those exist in Newport, Oregon.
I don't know if they're there anymore.
No, they're all of that. You'll find one if you hit the West Coast somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah. And there were several of us in there, and a Yugoslavian sailor came in from a freighter that had come into the harbor to pick up lumber or paper or something like that. And I expended my entire Russian vocabulary on him in about 30 seconds. But the group commander, who was a real salty World War II guy from the Coast Guard in World War II, happened to be sitting at the bar and overheard this exchange. So a couple of days later, the Soviets put out a SAR, not a SAR, but a medical evacuation, medevac. One of the sailors on one of the ships had appendicitis, and they needed to have him evacuated, brought into the United States where medical facilities were available for that. And so I was in watch in the tower, and my watch relief showed up 2 hours early, which is very suspicious. And then showed up, and he said, "The group commander wants to see you." And I said, "What for?" And he said, "Well, how the hell should I know? You know, when the group commander wants to see you in the middle of your watch, why, you just get very suspicious."
Right, yeah.
What might be going on, you
what
know?
Phone call did
he's
I
a
miss?
Warren. Yeah, he's a W-4 and I'm an E-2. So I went back to the station about three-quarters of a mile from the tower. And he called me into his office and he said, "Pete," called me Pete. "And I have this one favor I want you to do for me just this one time." And he said that there is a rescue medical vac going on and they need somebody to speak Russian, and I know you can do this. Well, okay, what are you going to say?
You picked up Russian to like almost maybe not meet the need, but to satisfy your curiosity, right? About what was going on.
Yep, that was it. Just curiosity, just something to do while standing those boring watches in the tower.
You must be the greatest draftee in the history of the United States. I don't know. I mean, how many, you know, most people I would think, obviously all volunteer force now, but being drafted, I would think a whole lot of people are disgruntled. Did you come in that way, or were you just, you know, bright-eyed and
bushy? Well, I was not pleased to get drafted. It wasn't the Coast Guard that drafted me. The Coast Guard hadn't drafted anybody since World War II. But I had, when I got my draft notice, I went to the Coast Guard recruiter and told him what was going on and told him my dad had been in the Coast Guard and so on. He called my dad up on the phone in Montana, and he called. And the recruiter told him what was going on. And my dad called an admiral who he served with when he was just a Lieutenant JG sometime in his Coast Guard history. And this admiral, I do not know who he was, but he did this for my dad. And by 1500, I was in the Coast Guard that afternoon.
See, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is why you treat junior officers with respect. Because one day they're
going to fill
that
someday
role.
They're going to fill that role sometime. And so he did that favor for my dad. He remembered my dad. And so I got drafted and I got sent to Alameda to boot camp. And I knew pretty much what to expect. Boot camp wasn't such a big shock. My dad had pretty much filled me in. But one thing my dad had said repeatedly over the years was the Coast Guard would treat you like a real human being. And that kind of stuck with me, other than the other military services. So, and then after after boot camp, why I ended up in Quantico Bay. So this situation happens with the Russian who's being brought in.
Joe, just before we go into it, since you brought up your dad, you know, what was kind of his background? It seemed like he had a pretty interesting story. You know, was there for a major history. Yeah.
Yes, he was. Well, my dad joined the Coast Guard in 1940 because he saw a film clip in a movie theater about icebreakers. And he thought, that's something I want to do. So he wanted to go to icebreakers.
Wow, those guys are
so he joined the Coast Guard. And he joined the Coast Guard, went to boot camp Port Townsend, Washington, and was sent to Bikini in Hawaii, of course. And he was there on December the 7th, 1941, and he was on the gun that fired the first shot off the Bikini at that particular time. And my dad was, you know, on the Taney, as I say. And then he was on several other stations. My dad was also a champion heavyweight boxer in the Navy. The Coast Guard was part of the Navy at that time. And as I understand it, the Coast Guard rewarded him for a fight that he fought and won. And he was sent to the 13th District, and he wanted to get married to my mom, so they sent him to Port Orchard, Oregon, which was a shore patrol, the guys with the dogs and the horses and all. Right. And he was a storekeeper. And so they got married there at Marshfield, Oregon, which then became Coos Bay, where I ended up getting stationed in 66. Then my dad was a plank holder on the troop ship, the General Murr, which was a Coast Guard manned troop ship. And he went all over the world on that troop ship, and he was in France at Le Havre, and they gave him, because he was a big guy, I guess, they gave him and some other big guys the shore patrol duty. And they would have to ride on the train with all these sailors and stuff that were going to Paris for liberty.
Oh, God. I cannot imagine those train rides.
This is, France was liberated, and he went to Paris, and he was assigned to directing traffic. And he said he was at the Champs-de-Lon with a baton in one hand and the bottle of cognac in the other. And whenever he drank all the cognac, another Parisian would rush out with a new, fresh bottle for him. I have photographs of my dad at those outdoor sidewalk cafes in Paris.
That's good.
So he was in Paris, and he went through the Suez Canal, and he went to India and all over like that. Then after the war, he stayed in the Coast Guard, and he was assigned to go with the Storrs when it came around from Greenland and came to Seattle. And my dad was a storekeeper in Seattle, and they assigned him to the Storrs, and they came up to Juneau, Alaska, where he helped form the 17th District. And Storrs was stationed there in Juneau at that time, and that's where we lived. And in 1948, my dad took me aboard the Storrs for ice cream. And I remember that quite well, so how could I not join the Coast Guard?
Right.
You know, I had ice cream on a cutter. And my grandmother was a seamstress, and she made me a set of blues, dress blues, Coast Guard ones with a flat hat and the patch on my sleeve and everything. And a second-class storekeeper crow on my arm and all that stuff. And I have pictures of me in that outfit, too. And but my dad, and then my dad went to, he was in Seattle, and then he was sent to Boston. He was in the first district, I think it is, in Boston. And then he was in, I think it was Cleveland, Ohio, in the district office there, somewhere in there, either Boston or Cleveland or somewhere in there. He worked with Alex Haley.
Okay. Yeah, the writer.
Because my dad was very interested in publishing stuff, you know, newsletters or whatever was necessary. And that's what he worked with Haley. And I think Haley was the chief. My dad was the first class.
What a small Coast Guard, huh?
Yeah, it is a small Coast Guard. And so he decided that advancement was too slow after the war. And my mom was tired of traveling around. And she didn't want him boxing either. He was still boxing for the Coast Guard. So he got out of the Coast Guard in 1952 and we settled down in Montana. But my dad was a Coastie in heart up till his death in 2001. But he went to many reunions, did many things for the Coast Guard, and he helped form the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. We have a display on Comanche here, the historic Coast Guard cutter Comanche. The wardroom has been converted to a World War II museum featuring the Coast Guard, and I have my dad's stuff from Pearl Harbor and other places on display in there. And his Pearl Harbor Survivors uniform, the lifetime membership.
Very cool.
And he went to a lot of those cars. Then towards the, in later in his life, why the Coast Guard would ask him to give interviews about Pearl Harbor. And the Coast Guard archives in Washington, D.C. has a video that they made of my dad in 2001 on the 60th anniversary. He was invited to the Taney on Memorial Day, and but he was too ill to go, so he didn't, and we mailed them his Taney log. He has a beautiful large Taney log with handwritten accounts of the attack on Pearl Harbor and things like that. And his Blue Jacket manual, too, has a handwritten account of the attack on Pearl Harbor and other things he encountered while he was in the Coast Guard during the war.
Yeah, I mean, that's an insanely great treasure right there. I'm just thinking of Blue Jacket's manual with notes from you know, from the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
Unreal.
Right. Oh, yeah, we have that, and the Coast Guard's aware of it, and the museum out here, Coast Guard Museum Northwest, has asked for a medal. The Congress gave him a medal. It's on a long ribbon, you know, around his neck. And he has that in the letter from a congressman congratulating him that he got this medal from Congress and so on and so forth. And they're interested in that medal, and the Coast Guard Archives would like to have his Taney log. And some of the docents and people who are officers in the, you know, civilian officers in the Taney organization today have come to look at those things and take photographs of them and all that kind of business.
So, Joe,
so that was my dad.
I was
going to
say, it's obvious that you come from quality stock, Joe, so it doesn't surprise me that you learned Russian to meet the need. That's pretty good.
I taught myself, right. Yeah. Well, my mother was also one of the very first to join the Women's Auxiliary Army Air Corps. In February of 42, there was 200 and some women that were allowed to join that, and they had to have a college degree and all that. My mother joined that organization and was taught, she went to boot camp in St. Louis, where she became a jazz aficionado. And she was trained in air traffic control towers, and she was sent to, I think it was Eglin Field in Florida, where unbeknownst to her, she was helping train Doolittle's Raiders. And she did not know that until after the fact. And so both my parents were in the war, in the military at that time. But my mother was not granted veteran status till 1993.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've heard of that being a problem, you know, with our female volunteers.
Yes, and she was very proud of that, that they finally did that, recognize her name's
right,
on
right,
some wall
so.
There in D.C.
Right.
Yeah. And so anyway, then I come along in life, and I end up like, where were we? Oh, at Yaquana Bay Station.
With the Russian crew.
Right. And I was very grateful to be at Yaquana Bay Station. It was a great place to be stationed. And the Russians have this medical evac, and so they sent me out on the 52-footer, 52312, which is the queen of the fleet today. And we're supposed to go out there and pick up this Russian. Well, in the meantime, Astoria Air Station sends a helicopter out and picks him up and brings him to the hospital in Newport, Oregon. So we turn around and we come back, and I go up to the station house, and the group commander wants to see me again. So I go in there, and he says, change into your whites and take this with you. And he hands me an empty briefcase with nothing in it. He said it makes you look more important, and handed me the briefcase. And he gave me his yeoman. His last name was Philpott, second-class yeoman, who was quite a character. And he gave me his car, the government car. And Philpott put me in the back seat, and we drove to the hospital. And then he gets out, goes around, opens the door for me, and there's all kinds of newspaper people there, and there's a little crowd of people there because this is the first one to come into the United States, and some people are irate and some are sympathetic and so on. And so they bring me into the hospital through the crowd of people there, and the guy is in a hospital room. And I, on the way over, I took my phrase book and learned the phrase gedebelit, which means where does it hurt. And I asked him at any pointed it on his left side, and he says, appendix. And the doctors are looking at me anxiously, and I said, he said it's his appendix. And they go, oh, it's his appendix. You know, so matter of fact, I'll tell you something funny about that.
Did you have to translate appendix, or did he just say appendix?
He said appendix.
Yeah, that's funny.
Pretty clear that
it
must be that. Well, there are a lot of similar words. Matter of fact, there were incidences we had where the Russians would be speaking English, and our own personnel, the Coast Guard personnel, couldn't understand him, and I just translate the Russian English with an accent into English that our crew could understand.
Well, yeah, and that happens all
the time. I figured out.
That's definitely, I mean, I'm guilty of that, I think. And then it always seems the volume gets a little louder, right, when someone doesn't understand.
Oh, yeah, they think that, right. You're going to understand it if they talk louder.
Yeah, if I yell it a little.
Oh, that was... Yeah, you yell at or wave your hands or something.
Right.
But that was always amused me. But I figured out years later why it was I could understand them speaking English with an accent, because my grandmother was from Sweden and had a very heavy Swedish accent, and I could certainly understand my grandmother. But I started as a little boy in grade school speaking English with a Swedish accent.
Okay.
And they brought that up to my parents one time. You need to do something about that. But my grandmother used to say I had no accent until I come to this country. She couldn't figure out where the accent came from.
Right.
Anyway, so translate with that guy, and I thought that was the end of it. Well, no. The MODOK had an incident, the Cutter MODOK, 143 feet, World War II fleet tug, smallest of their class, and it was the smallest of the medium endurance cutters. And MODOK had an incident where the captain or the commissar of the Soviet fishing fleet had a heart attack aboard the mothership, the Cherkin, and the MODOK was out there, I think, on station and came over to see what they could do, because the Russians called for help. And they went aboard, they lowered the small boat and went over and went aboard. And they brought with them a second-class engineman who knew mouth-to-mouth, because the corpsman was on leave. And they were ushered into the cabin, the commissar's cabin, and he was laying on the floor dead, and he'd been dead about an hour. Nobody knew what to do, so the second-class engineman got down and started giving him mouth-to-mouth. Well, the corpse puked up bile into the engineman's mouth, and the engineman started puking, and everybody in the room started puking, and it became apparent something has to happen. And they took the body back to the United States. I think they took it into Astoria, and the Russians ordered up a zinc coffin for him, which was later brought out, I think, by the Coast Guard lifeboat station there at the El Waco. And so they decided they needed help, and so I was sent to the MODOK TAD, the first three trips to MODOK in the summers of 66 were temporary additional duty.
So, Joe,
and I would go out.
Joe, just going back to the zinc coffin, do you know why? I'm thinking like a zinc diode on a boat or whatever. Is it so it'll break down at sea, or what's the...
Oh, I have no idea. I don't even know if they gave him a burial at sea. I don't know what they did with it. I wasn't directly involved in that particular incident.
Yeah,
I
was just
curious. You know, I have the story secondhand.
Right.
I have no idea what that was about.
Yeah, I'll have to look that one up.
Speaking of coffins, so I'm at Yaquana Bay at Newport, and two guys in suits show up. Suits with ties, which was unusual, and they wanted to talk to me. And they set me down at the mess deck table and kind of were quizzing me about where I learned Russian and all that kind of stuff. And I was sort of a smart ass, and I said, if you can't trust your Russian translators, who can you trust? They didn't like that.
No, those guys don't have humor. Whenever you get those guys.
No, they have no humor. They had no humor, and I like humor. But so they told me that they gave me one instruction. They said, under no circumstances will there be any defectors. If they have to go back, they'll go back in the pine box.
There we go.
And that was the only instructions I ever got.
It's pretty much a line in
now,
the sand,
if you know,
I
you
say.
Yeah. I never had any incidences where anybody wanted to defect. But shortly after I got out of the Coast Guard in 69, I think it must have been 1970, one did try to defect on the East Coast by jumping off a Soviet fishing boat onto a Coast Guard cutter and claiming that he was an American citizen, but the Coasties let the Russians come aboard and kind of beat him silly and drag him back, and thought that was the end of it. But there was a civilian reporter aboard who, you know, published it, and the crap hit the fan. And it was found out that this man was, his parents were from Lithuania. They came to the United States. He was born in the United States. He was indeed an American citizen. There was one of the admirals lost his job, a captain lost his job, and a book was written about it, then a movie was made about it. You know, you check your Coast Guard history.
It's still lore for all of active duty. I think that's a story that, you know, that I've heard repeatedly. Every time you talk about asylum or dealing with an international boat, yeah, it's still that incident is still a thing for sure.
Oh yeah, it should be. And so I'm in Yakima, Washington at the time, and I call up Warren Magnuson's office, our senator, and I say, yeah, you know, I want to talk about this thing. You know, I was given clear instructions that there'd be no defectors. And they said, well, we'll call you back. And they said, thank you for your information. They called me back a couple of days later and told me to keep my mouth shut.
Roger that.
Yeah. So what am I going to do? You know, I don't want to have any trouble with that kind of power.
Right.
So it was unfortunate for those Coasties. I think that they understood that they weren't supposed to allow any defectors either. But what are you going to do, you know?
Yeah, and you know how the Coast Guard, you know how it works. I mean, that was definitely a one-off, right? Like a surprise thing.
And oh, yeah.
It definitely, it was a 50-50 shot. You either got it right or you didn't, and they didn't.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it just took them all by big surprise. Right. And what are you going to do? You know, you can't keep him because, you know, they no doubt knew. When I gave my talk on the Soviet fishing fleet in Bremerton, Washington, a few weeks ago, there was a retired admiral there who had been involved with the Russian fishing fleet, and he was talking about when he was involved 10 years after I was involved, and he said that was something that they understood there'd be no defectors. Anyway, that was that incident. And anyhow, so I end up on the MODOK, and because I could read the Cyrillic, I could translate the names of the Russian ships into phonetic English. I could read that.
And how big was the fleet, Joe, off the West Coast? Like, how many boats are we talking?
Right. Well, one time we did count 110 vessels off just the Oregon coast.
Wow.
Spread out over, 50, 60 miles, 3 to 20 miles off the coast. There was just a 3-mile limit then, and there really weren't any treaties. There was nothing much that we could do about enforcing anything because there were no laws to really enforce. But what we wanted to do is find out what they're doing and who's there, and that's what we would do. We spent many, many hours watching them fish and getting the names, collecting the names, and then going over lists of other Russian ships that we were aware of, and doing that. And then I would, I did a number of medical evacuations. There was maybe a half a dozen medical evacuations in the 13th district that one way or another, I would be involved in it somehow. And it got to the point where the Soviets wouldn't speak to anybody unless I was there. And that, again, raised big questions about me.
Who is this guy?
Who is this guy? Yep. What do you do with this guy? What's going on? Oh, yeah, I used to get lectures on communism and marijuana, whatever the connection was there. And I don't think they understood that the Soviet Union was very, very anti-drug. Because the Soviet Union was very conservative. It was not a liberal country, you know. And real conservative. Their favorite presidents were, you know, Nixon and Reagan and things like that. So, anyway, I spent quite a bit of time with Soviet ships. I showed slides the other night. I have maybe 40, 50 slides of us next to Russian ships, close to them, trading stuff with them. And, you know, the curiosity was insatiable. They were curious, we were curious, and we would sometimes find one of their ships out by itself fishing, and we would coax them alongside and trade stuff and, you know, just sort of fraternize for a little while. And eventually discouraged.
How big are they?
How big?
Yeah, and how many crews?
The small ones were around 100 feet to 110 feet, and then you had ones up to about 600 feet. You had some big factory ships, big tankers, big freighters. You had a pretty good-sized variety of vessels that were involved in this fishing industry.
And they were just...
And they were fishing for...
Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
They were fishing for hake, which is a bottom fish that we didn't fish for.
Okay.
We had no use for hake, but they would make bone meal out of it for fertilizer. They would actually freeze it for human consumption and so on and so forth. But our American fishermen, of course, thought they were catching all of the salmon. And we didn't really see any evidence of that or halibut or anything like that. Occasionally you would see where an individual would have a salmon and he'd have the salmon fillets hanging out of a porthole drying in the sun. One time we came across a Soviet smaller fishing boat, 110-footer, SRT we called them. And they had fillets of what we appeared to be halibut hanging over the exhaust of the diesel engine, you know, out the stack.
Yeah.
Yummy, yummy.
Yeah, right. Those are good.
And you could smell the Soviet fleet before you could see them. If you were downwind from them, you'd get this nauseating smell of dried fish.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
And such. And they, many of their boats are very, very rusty. I asked them one time, how come they don't paint your ships? And they said, because paint doesn't catch fish. Well, they were very pragmatic.
Right.
And, of course, people thought they were spying and planting homing devices or things like that. But we found no evidence of anything like that. And that wasn't our job. Our job was fisheries patrol.
Since you said you saw no evidence of that, I'll just ask you a random question. There's a painting in Yorktown that I've seen, right? And we always mm-hmm. wondered what it was. It's just a, you know, sea of blue with a 41-footer and a big ship in front of it, probably about 100 feet. Always wonder what it was. And finally, we noticed the flag, and it was a Russian flag. And mm-hmm. asked around, and sure enough, somebody supposedly knew the story, but a Russian ship somewhere off the coast of New York or New Jersey, I guess there's a sub base up there, or was. And this ship had come over to, I'm assuming just spy on the, the sub movements, right? Did you ever hear about anything about that? Or, you know, because I know you're...
We actually knew what the spy boats looked like. I mean, the United States knew which what boats were spy boats.
The ones with the antennas.
And well, antennas, but there were certain types of Russian fishing vessels that we knew were spying. We rarely ever saw anything like that, and they're usually off by themselves. They're not in big nest of boats or anything.
Right.
Oh, yeah, sure, they're spying Bangor submarine base off of here, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah, there's no doubt that somebody's spying.
Right.
But it wasn't, for the most part, it certainly wasn't the ones we were hanging out with and having to check out. They were definitely fishing.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that a fishing boat can't spy. They may have been doing that. But we didn't have any hardcore evidence that they were doing any such thing. You know, they were fishing, and we had fisheries personnel with us. Federal Fisheries Department would send somebody out, and they would take a lot of pictures of the fish they're catching. We were concerned with what kind of fish they were catching. Now, mind you, there's no treaties at that time, so there really wasn't a heck of a lot that we could do about it except report it. We did catch a Russian SRP, the 110-footers, one time within the three-mile limit off of Grays Harbor. And we had been anchored in Grays Harbor, and we heard that the fishermen were catching salmon a little ways south, so we pulled up our anchor and went off to go fish for salmon. And on the way, we went past this Russian ship, and we just went right by, didn't pay much attention to it, and then the quartermaster said he's inside the limit. Well, we had to stop.
Right.
We had to turn around and go back. And the captain of the Russian ship knew that he had been caught, and he was apologizing and all that stuff. And our gunner's mate was on the mess deck with an M1 just in case some incident happened. And we had to wait for a message from Charlie Gulf Delta 13, the 13th headquarters there. And we got after about an hour of, heaving to and drifting around this Russian ship, the message came back to let them go because of the first day of the Six-Day War in 1967, and we didn't want to create an incident with the Soviets, so we let them go.
Yeah, wow, it had international implications. I do think it's funny, though, that nothing changes, that you guys, you know, something happens and it takes you an hour to get an answer. Nothing's changed.
Yeah, oh, I'm pretty sure, and it was even more archaic communications back then.
Right.
You know, and then there were a number of medical evacuations that I was involved in with the Soviets. I had one officer one time, and this was just right outside of Coos Bay, and he was a captain in the Russian fishing fleet, and it was really bad seas, and the 52-footer and the 44-footer from Coos Bay just could not get alongside of it to take the guy off, and the helicopter was too rough for a helicopter. So we got permission for him to come in across the Coos Bay Bar, and it was the first Soviet ship to enter American waters since World War II. And he just came in, made a circle, and went out. And the guy got off, and we took him to the Coast Guard station and then to the hospital. And he gave me a letter from the commissar, which basically, you know, that this man is an officer of great repute and all that kind of stuff. And he had appendicitis, and the news media was very interested in him. And I have newspaper clippings of the Russian ship and the 52-footer circling it, and the pictures of me with that Russian officer, you know. But he was the only member of the Communist Party that I ever met that I was aware of that was a member of the Communist Party. Most of them were apolitical, just like anybody else. They weren't too interested in politics. They were interested in American culture, television, magazines, American cigarettes, ballpoint pens, and things like that that they didn't have.
Women.
Pardon?
Women. Interested in our women. I'm just kidding. That's what my...
Oh, yeah, they were sailors, you know? Yep.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, that's how sailors are.
Mm-hmm. They wanted Dama Journals, girly magazines.
Okay. I like how you can translate that, Joe. That's pretty good.
Well, there was important things. You got any vodka, you know, stuff like that. I learned to translate some important stuff.
Right.
The interesting thing is, if you got something on one end of the Russian ship and you didn't want it, you went up to the other end and traded it back to another Russian.
There you go. You can't beat that. Yeah, that's a good system.
No, you can't. They had stuff from all over the communist empire, you know, and so, and we wanted anything and everything. They wanted anything and everything, you know. I mean, just intense curiosity over each other, because there were so many misconceptions of it, and food and drink and whatever, you know, they were interested in it.
And Joe, was there any fallout in the local community, since, you know, you're talking a lot of medevacs and stuff, bringing in Russian fishing fleet that I'm sure, I mean, just knowing the West Coast fishing fleet, I'm sure these, you know, our fishermen hated them. There's no doubt in my mind.
Oh, yeah.
You know, was there any animosity bringing these guys to shore and kind of facilitating that type of stuff? Did you guys, any fallout from it?
Yes, there was some. People would be very angry. Sometimes they get angry letters in the mail. But in most cases, they would get well cards from the public.
Yeah.
That would come to the hospital. But there were certainly problems. There were a few incidences that we heard of where American fishermen go out and take pot shots at the Russians. And the Russians would actually complain about that, but we never caught anybody doing that, but I'm sure they did. Yeah, there was a lot of anger about that. I was treated pretty good, though. I would go into, there were a couple of bars I'd go into where they had a piano player or an organ player, and they would play a Russian song or something, along with Semper Paratus. And I would sometimes get followed around by the media asking me questions and so on. It became apparent to me as I went along that one of my major unspoken roles was to assure the public, the media, that we had everything under control and nothing can go wrong, you know.
Yeah,
so
that's still primary tasking, I'd say, for
that, yeah, there's, so there, absolutely, there was that kind of propaganda on our side too, though I was never tutored to talk that way. I could certainly understand from a few meetings I had that I was to leave an impression that we got everything under control.
Right.
And when we didn't, most of the time we had no idea what was going on.
And how old were you when you
came in?
How old were you when you came in?
I was 20 years old. I turned 21 in boot camp.
Yeah.
If you can imagine that, I'm standing there at Alameda on the end of the island looking at the lights of San Francisco on my 21st birthday, and I can't go anywhere.
Right.
Yeah,
it's a lot of pressure for a 21-year-old man with, you know, only a few months in the service.
Yeah, it was, but what am I going to do, you know? I mean, everybody expected this, and...
And you brought it on yourself, Joe, because you learned Russian.
Yeah, I did bring it up. Oh, yeah, don't I know it. But I've had a lot of fun with it, you know.
Right.
In many kinds of ways, you know. And all my shipmates from back then, when we have reunions and whatnot, they always introduce me as the Russian translator.
Right. That's good. Well, you know what?
I had a friend of mine.
Joe, it's funny they say that, because whenever I was talking to Bill, I was like, yeah, it's the Russian translator. So, that name's carried over.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Somebody asked one of the Russians one time who spoke very good English, can Joe really speak Russian? And he looked at me and he said, yes, Joe can speak Russian. We Russians haven't learned yet.
That's good.
Yeah, they were, you know, they were all right. You would meet some that were angry people, didn't like Americans, just like we had some people on our cutters who were, you know, hostile about something. But by and large, it went all right. We didn't mean them any malice, and they didn't seem to mean us any malice either. And later on, when treaties changed, everything kind of changed. And the Coast Guard started inspecting Russian ships. And Comanche, where I'm sitting right now, was the first American vessel to give a notice of violation to a foreign fishing ship. And Comanche had seized Russian ships, and Modoc seized Russian ships as time went by, as the Magnuson Act came into play. But such a thing didn't exist. Like I said, it was a 3-mile limit, then it went to a 12-mile limit while I was in the Coast Guard. I have photographs of the Russian ships fishing in with Newport, Oregon in the background. You know, they were unreal. They'd go right up to the 3 mile limit. Yeah.
Yeah, having lived and worked under the Magnuson Act, right? Like to even see that now would be kind of mind blowing, I think, because it would just never happen.
Right. And we couldn't really do anything. We didn't have really any authority to bust them because there wasn't any law there to back it up.
Right.
So we did record a lot of stuff, and much of what we recorded, of course, becomes fuel for the Magnuson Act.
Right.
You know, the reports that were turned in and so on and so forth. It was kind of an interesting time.
You guys
time
set the stage for a lot of fun going forward, I would say, because, you know, enforcing the Magnuson Act can be a good time once you learn how to
Certainly later on, both on MODOK and Comanche, after I was gone, they did enforce it. And we heard these stories last night, we gave a talk in Port Townsend, and there was a man who was an ensign on Comanche at that time, talked about boarding Russian ships and inspecting everything, the log, and crawling into any space and all that kind of stuff, and fining them hundreds of thousands of dollars and things like that. That would be a different kind of ball game.
Right. Well, and Joe, since you're on board the Comanche now, why don't you tell us about what you're into these days with the Comanche specifically?
Sure. Well, the Comanche was the sister cutter of the MODOK, and the Comanche was one of the Navy hand-me-downs that came to the Coast Guard after the war. And it was built as a fleet tug, and there were three sizes of fleet tugs, and these, named ATAs, were the smallest at 143 feet, and they were the shallowest. And they built 89 of them towards the end of the war in Port Arthur, Texas, and Livingston, Texas, were the two places where they built these. And they were built for the anticipated invasion of Japan, so they're very sturdy steel tugs. And in some ways, they were cutting-edge technology with new types of diesel-electric power plants and things like that. And the ATAs were also called by the Navy. We have an article about them that the Navy had published in 1946 where the Navy calls them attack tugs. And they would go in with the invasion fleet because they had a shallow draft, shallower than the bigger tugs. And they could go in and they could haul out damaged landing craft and other vessels and get them out of the way so the invasion could continue. And they would give some fire cover to the invading American troops or British or whatever they might be. This one, Comanche, as ATA 202, didn't have a name during World War II. It was just ATA 202. It was strafed by the Japanese, received shore fire and different things like that, and it had quite a history. In the first 9 months that it was in the theater of war in the Pacific, it cruised over 25,900 miles all the way from New Zealand to Leyte Gulf.
That's a lot.
And it was involved. Yeah, it is. And it was involved in the invasion of Okinawa, for which it received a battle star. And we have met a couple of the Navy crew that were on it at that time, and these gentlemen are now passed on, but they told us they would watch the kamikazes crash into the American ships and then to see if they could render any kind of service. In some cases, they would tow damaged American ships out of the action, out further to sea, and then determine whether they could be saved and hauled to repair facility, probably at Ulithi Atoll, or if it should be sunk. And so they would sometimes have to sink them with their 3-inch 50 gun.
Right.
So, it had quite a history. And we have some of that history. We have some interesting things that were published on the ship at that time. Then it came and ended up in Reserve Fleet in Corpus Christi, Texas. And in 1959, the Coast Guard was wanting more endurance cutters, or just cutters, you know, to deal with search and rescue and fisheries patrols, and they selected the ATA 202 out of Texas, and that becomes the Comanche. They tow it up to Cape May. We have photographs of it up there in Cape May being converted to a Coast Guard cutter. And the Modoc was in the reserve fleet here in Olympia, Washington, and in 1959. It was selected as a cutter sent to Coos Bay, which was its home port for most of its career. So both Modoc and Comanche spent quite a bit of time on the Pacific Coast. Comanche did spend some time for the Coast Guard in Corpus Christi in the late 60s as piracy patrol. Chasing real pirates before Johnny Depp was born.
What kind of pirates did we have down in the Gulf in the 60s?
Well, the people stealing boats and things like that.
Yeah.
It's still considered piracy patrol.
Sure, yeah, I just didn't know if it was like an organized group or what they had, I guess.
I don't know if it was organized crime or what, but it went on.
Somebody hoisted the flag.
I don't know what they did, but a lot of people do that now. I remind people come on the ship to visit it, and they're dressed up like pirates, and I remind them that the ship chased real pirates.
Right. You just tell them get off.
Anyhow,
just point back to the pier and get off.
Yeah, something like that. Nah, they're okay. You know, they're pretend world. And then it did some spy activity down in South America where they would run out of water, and neither Modoc or Comanche could make water, so they had to spread canvas on the fantail, which is quite large, and collect rainwater and put it into the water tanks. And then it came back to the West Coast in 1970, I believe it was, and engaged in the Soviet fishing fleet patrols along with Modoc. It was stationed in Eureka, California, until it was decommissioned in 1980, and Modoc was likewise decommissioned at the same time. One of the reasons I read in a Coast Guard, old Coast Guard magazine, was that the 12th District Admiral for the Coast Guard thought they were deplorable living conditions. And, testify to that.
I was going to say, you can't fault him for looking out for the guys, right?
Yeah, I guess so. And also at that time, you know, they're starting to put women on cutters, and I don't think that works so good on one of these, but both vessels were sold to private parties, and Comanche down in San Francisco got sold to a private party, and then that got sold to a scrap yard, and a tug company, Thunder Pacific Towing, bought it for towing in San Francisco and brought it up to Tacoma, where they converted it back to an ocean-going tug. And Modoc in the 80s was sold to a man who built yachts. He built them out of fiberglass, but he wanted something better for his own home. So he did his research and discovered that these ATAs have extraordinarily strong hulls. So Modoc just happened to be in his neighborhood. So he bought Modoc for scrap value and converted it into a $4 million love boat.
Man, who would have thought?
Yeah,
who would have thought, huh?
Yeah. Oh, no, when we had our first reunion on board, Modoc is luxury. It had a marble fireplace, jacuzzis, hot tubs, just outrageously beautiful vessel. And so the media came on board when we had our reunion on there, and I told a newspaper reporter, if they'd done this when I was in the Coast Guard, I would never have left.
You'd still be in. That's good. I remember.
I'd still be there.
Well, I was talking to, we talked before about Mr. Cranus, and he said they had a name for the Modoc and the Comanche, and that was the stomach pump.
Oh, yeah, they were the, absolutely. Officers and crew members who stay in the Coast Guard and retire and had served on any number of ships all said that the Comanche and Modoc were the worst riding ships they ever were on.
Yeah.
And they were. That's what they were. They were puke buckets. Absolutely.
So how did the association that's now converted the Comanche into a museum, how did that come about? Were you, I know you're a member, obviously, and I know she's sailing now. So,
right.
Yeah, just tell everybody listening, like, one, how it came about, and then two, how can they, A, support it, and then B, visit it?
Sure. Well, somewhere in early 1993, when they brought it here to convert it to a commercial tug, myself and another MODOC veteran and I were driving along the waterfront in Tacoma, and we saw it. And, of course, we were shocked. We thought it was MODOC. And we had to go around the other side of the waterway to see that it had on its stern Comanche. And we were then doubly shocked because Comanche was in Texas when we were in Oregon with the MODOC. So we were quite surprised. And we didn't have much connection with it until 2006. In 2006, it had moved from where it was. They had it tied up on the Foss Waterway in downtown Tacoma. And they had moved it, and the Coast Guard Tug Association wanted to know where it went. So I figured it went to the scrapyard. And I took my sailboat up there, up the Heilbos Waterway to the big scrapyard. Sure enough, there it was, tied up at the scrapyard. Well, that didn't satisfy them. They wanted to know what the scrapyard was going to do with it. And I thought, well, that looks obvious to me.
Right.
But I went to the scrapyard and asked them, you know, and they said, no, we're not scrapping it. It's just parked there. It's for sale. And are you interested? I said, well, I guess so. And they took my name and phone number and got a hold of the guy who owned it, and he called me that day. Wanted to know why I was interested. Well, there was a group in California in the San Francisco Bay Area, a fledging group called the American Fleet Tug Museum. And they wanted an ATA, so I got them in contact with each other, and the guy who owned it agreed to give it to them. Well, somewhere that summer, things fell apart between the owner of Comanche and the American Fleet Tug Museum, and he rescinded his donation. And he approached me and a couple of the other coasties who had been drifting around it and said, look, you guys form a nonprofit, and I'll give it to you. And, of course, I immediately refused it. And then a couple months later, he called me up and said, look, I'm going to move it to Olympia, about 35 miles away. And he said, I'm moving it there under its own power. How would you like to come along? I said, well, why not? You know, get to go for a ride on one.
Right.
And I invited a friend of mine who is an engineer, you know, on diesels and so on. And so he came along, and we rode the Comanche to Olympia, and it didn't blow up, burn up, or sink, or anything like that. It ran perfectly well, and I was quite surprised by that. Well, my friend, when we get into Olympia, he's all excited. He says, Joe, I think we ought to do it. I think we ought to accept this gift. And I said, well, let me talk to a couple other people about it first, because I'm the reluctant one. And I contacted a rear admiral I know who I would teach with in the military college programs, and a former XO on Comanche that I knew. And we all got aboard the ship and checked it out quite carefully in Olympia, Washington in May of 2007. And everybody agreed it should be safe. It was a floating museum. So we did the paperwork, and we were approved on September 11th, 2007 by the IRS. We were approved as a nonprofit organization. And on October 10th, its 65th birthday, the tug company gave it to us, gave us a gift of deed. And it came with tens of thousands of spare parts, all kinds of charts, all kinds of Coast Guard papers and records were still on it, which surprised me.
Right.
And then we just got started. I mean, we didn't start trying to get money to do it. We got volunteers, and we just started working at it. Because I had been on MODOC for quite some time as a deck ape, I knew what it was supposed to look like. So we started, painting and scraping. And first thing we painted was the stack. We painted it spar. And from there, we just kept going. And we have already, we put in 45,000 volunteer hours of labor into it. And we've done this on less than $25,000 a year. And we have cruised around quite a bit with it. Last year, we received the award for maintenance and preservation from the Historic Naval Ships Association.
I'm going to say right from the start, Joe, since you guys are cruising that thing around, even as we speak.
That is
a well-deserved award there.
Yeah, we're sitting here with the engines in idle waiting for the when they open the bridge. And we're ready to go. We're getting ready now to go into South Lake Union. So, Yeah, and it is, as far as we know, the other Coast Guard historians and whatnot say it's probably the only operational WNEC, our Coast Guard cutter, in the United States. It's a historic, you know, a non-profit historic vessel. We got museum displays on board about it, about World War II. We got a museum. We got a uniform display, all kinds of things.
And one of
the ship is just a big museum itself.
One of the coolest last jobs year, I've seen is what another one.
Oh yeah, well the starboard side, we decided that we started to see some of the other World War II ships, Navy ships, for the 75th anniversary of World War II paint. Camouflage, dazzle, paint job on their sides. And so we decided to do that on the starboard side. And we have some teens at risk, teenagers who volunteer on here, and they painted the starboard side in dazzle. And the port side is painted in a Coast Guard white with an orange stripe.
And that's what they call it, the dazzle paint scheme, huh? That's the name?
Yeah, right, for World War II. We don't know if it had that kind of paint scheme in World War II, but in honor of World War II, we have that paint scheme.
Right.
And we have thousands of people every year come and visit it. We are just finishing up 30 days of touring around to places. We probably had 3,000 or 4,000 people visit the ship in the last 30 days.
And where can people find her, Joe? Where can they find out more about the organization, and where can they, Coast Guard veterans,
well,
I know you're actively posting stories and stuff, but what a website for the association and social media, whatever you have.
Yeah, well, the email is ata202@live.com. That's the email. There is a Facebook page with 3,700 friends on it, and lots and lots and lots of pictures. I'm going to have to cut this off.
Nope.
I've got to go back.
No worries,
I got to go up,
Joe. That's why I wanted to get it out there. Hey, we so much appreciate you coming on today. Excellent story. Thank you so much for your service. Thanks for your father's service and for your mother's. And
well, thank you.
And we wish you all the safety getting in on the old Comanche and bringing her into port, sir. Thank you again.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.